Today in Studio 360, our series on American icons features a painter who really shaped the way we think about the American Southwest.
The men were all talking about the great American novel. Oh, it was the great American everything. And I thought a lot of them had never been across the Hudson. So I thought, I'll make my picture red, white, and blue. I'll make it an American painting.
Georgia O'Keeffe picks up a cow skull and makes history. We'll also remember the World Trade Center during an earlier time when the life and death danger was only exciting.
I was a young wire worker busy conquering an idea.
I talked to Philippe Petit about his high wire walk between the Twin Towers 37 years ago. That's all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Today on the show, a couple of very American artists, the novelist Jonathan Franzen and the painter Georgia O'Keeffe. But first,
there is somebody out there in a tightrope walk between the two towers of the World Trade Center, right at the tippy top.
It's August 7th, 1974, and President Nixon is just about to resign. But it was this surprising, literally marvelous news report that had people riveted.
That somebody was Philippe Petit, a 24-year-old Frenchman, doing his higher wire act 1,350 feet up and no net below.
Philippe Petit's illegal daredevil walk between the towers, 110 stories up, makes me woozy even to contemplate. As the 10-year anniversary of 9/11 approaches, it's worth remembering the Twin Towers when they were nothing but brand new and amazing. A terrific film about the walk, called Man on Wire, won the Oscar for Best Documentary. 3 years ago, I met up with Petit and the film's director, James Marsh, right by Ground Zero, where the towers used to stand. Philippe, here you are, 34 years later. You were 24 at the time. There you were, a quarter mile up. The Twin Towers were brand new. When you walked out there, do you remember what you felt like?
I have moment-to-moment memories, and the more I relive the past, the more I am able to actually recompose that and discovering new feeling that I thought had fluttered away. So, yes, I remember each of those eight crossing, and as you know, it was not planned. It just happened that I did one more and one more. It was a performance, but a strange kind of performance because my audience could not be invited in advance. And also they were a quarter of a mile below me, so, but still it was a performance. But it was also a very intimate dialogue with me and the birds, me and the sky of New York, me and the Twin Towers.
You and history as well, you must have thought.
No, I never thought of that.
No,
I was a young wire walker busy conquering an idea. I never thought of the consequences. I would have not cared if I had thought of the consequences. And I never thought of the fame, if it would come, knock at my door. No, this was not the reason I was there, and it was not part of my thinking.
You mentioned that you, and the film reenacts the moment when you first got this idea. Talk about that. It was only, what, 6-7 years before you actually did it. How did that happen?
Well, exactly as James reconstructed it and tells in his photoplay, I like that term.
Indeed, it's a photoplay.
Because it's a play. I mean, and the first scene is actually how I got the idea, and it's exactly how it appears in the film.
Here I am, young, 17 years old, with a bad tooth, in one of those uncolorful waiting room of a French dentist, and you have all ladies and people, you know, sheepishly looking at magazines, quiet, and suddenly I freeze. Because I have opened a newspaper at a page and I see something magnificent, something that inspires me. I see two towers. And the article says one day those towers will be built. They're not even there yet. And when they are, they will become the highest in the world.
And yes, I saw two buildings that was a rendering, because at the time they didn't exist yet.
And do you remember the first time you arrived in New York, sort of casing the joint and saw the...
I remember everything. I am an archivist at heart, and I have a sense for details. For example, before you said hello, I saw you arrive, and I know that the third button on your left sleeve is about to fall. Okay, so this is who I am. The street juggler in me pay attention. So yes, I remember vividly my first impression of New York. It was old and dirty, smelly, because there was a strike of garbage, and it was modern and beautiful. It was a big mess. And I remember my first vision of the towers and my first visit illegally in the towers.
You say that you noticed the button on my jacket, which is amazing. James, when you first met Philippe, he told you he had the mind of a criminal. Does that seem so?
Well, I'd read Philippe's book by the time we met, and his book lays out a very elaborate criminal conspiracy that he undertook with close friends and associates he found in the city. Certainly, I think that the kind of lateral thinking, the kind of imagination that he needed to conceive of this crime, if you like, and to conceive of the logistics of it and to execute it, was, you know, clearly the mind of someone who didn't respect boundaries and laws and rules. And that's one of the things I love
sanity,
about the story.
Some could argue.
I wouldn't argue that. But that's one of the things that I love about the story itself, is it has no respect for, you know, even the laws of nature, ultimately, in a way. So I wasn't surprised to find a man rummaging in my pockets and stealing things from me. And that was, I think, the basis under which we collaborated, was that sense of mischief and playfulness.
Philippe, you say in the film that while it was illegal, it wasn't wicked or mean, this violation of the law and of the norms of modern life. Did you see yourself at 24 as a kind of holy outlaw?
Oh, absolutely, but not at 24. It started at 4 years old. 4, 5, 6 years old, I was already building my independence and shaping my destiny. So yes, this kind of need for rebellion, and one could see it as arrogance, still is in me after all these years.
I remember people talking about how, this amazing act had humanized these gargantuan new buildings. Did you have any thought of, well, if you fail, if you fall?
Well, I would have loved to be able to have such a thought, but I am incapable of having such thoughts. I concentrate and I live and I walk forward what I want to do, which is to walk on a cable. The opposite of walking on a cable, flying away from a piece of steel on which you walk, I'm incapable of entertaining that thought, because it's in a different world than the one that I have created and I decided to live in.
Yeah, so it is the ultimate power of positive thinking.
I don't think it's only thinking. I think it's much more than that. I think it's the chemistry of your blood in your veins and the pulsation of your heart, or the many hearts you don't even know.
So you're
you
like
possess.
A superhero. You're not a mortal.
No, the word hero, I run far away from it, but I know it's a nice word in America. You have gurus, you have heroes, you have gods, but...
Superman.
Superman, yes. I do not have heroes in my life. I have great artists who have inspired me, and I suddenly would never label myself as a hero. I am too busy building the next
project. But that ability to, on this molecular level, the level of your blood, to not allow for this idea of failure and falling, makes you not like most people, not like anyone I can imagine.
Well, you can pronounce toward me the word alien, and okay. I will be honored. But the word hero, no.
Okay. There's a particularly gasp-inspiring still of you on the wire between the buildings, where there's this big jetliner over your shoulder, essentially. And as one sees that, can't help but think of 9/11. Do you remember having at this, doing this wondrous, amazing, marvelous thing 20 years, 18 years later, hearing about 9/11 and what you thought?
What is beautiful is what James decided to show in his film, is that those towers are still present, and it will be very nice, besides remembering them in their drama and in their horror and death, it will be nice that there is a work of art, a beautiful film, that remember those towers in their glory. Even people who are completely living into the drama part, let's say people who lost their loved one in a disaster of 9/11, they come to James and I and they say, you know, it's amazing, it's a revelation. I realize actually when you lose somebody, you should remember that person in tears, but also in laughter. In doom, but also in glory. So I think it's beautiful that James decided to really separate my adventure. Yes, the thing in common with 9/11 is the Twin Towers, but those Twin Towers had a life before they had a death, and that's what this film is about.
And of course, you know, we're all aware of the subtext, and it's there for everyone. Everyone in the whole world is familiar with the imagery and the fact of their demise, and it felt a blasphemy to burden Philippe's story with any discussion or any reference to that horror show. And it's a film and a story about them being built and then being conquered and being celebrated in a certain kind of way. And it would be wrong to put some kind of crass interpretation on that. And I think people should enjoy the film for what it is, as a celebration of this, you know, miracle that was performed down there, this gripping kind of adventure story.
Philippe, did you like the buildings?
I fell in love with them. I am unable to stretch a cable between two structures that I do not fall in love with.
Really?
And repeatedly in my life, in a silly way, I say no to high wire propositions. I am not interested. And it's usually because artistically it makes no sense for me.
If there were two buildings of the right height, suitable to you, and you fell in love with them, would you want to repeat this?
Well, yes, and I actually publicly announced that long time ago. I said, if the two towers are rebuilt in some kind of twin ways, you know, not exactly the same, but two towers, I will offer to New York to do a walk, you know, a dance against doom in some ways, and have all New York and whole world, you know, celebrating the fact that it's built again, except unfortunately, very unfortunately, there will be one structure, not two, so I obviously need two structures to walk on
maybe,
a high wire.
Maybe from this film, the developers will help get the idea that some of the subsequent buildings, two of the subsequent buildings could be twins.
Well, they certainly had enough time to talk about it.
And they'll have more. Well, thank you both very much.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
And I'll be sure to get my button sewn back on. James Marsh's documentary about Philippe Petit is called Man on Wire. We spoke in 2008. Coming up, it's been argued that today's male American novelists are reticent writing about sex. Jonathan Franzen says, not him.
There's a lot of sex in dreams, and you put yourself into that dream state to do the writing, and sex comes along. It's really as simple as that.
That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. If you're a writer, especially a novelist, it's hard not to feel just a teeny bit envious of Jonathan Franzen. Back in 2001, his novel The Corrections became that extremely rare thing, a big, ambitious literary novel that's also a big bestseller. His latest book, Freedom, earned him more giant sales, more rapturous reviews. A Time magazine cover story headlined Great American Novelist. It's out in paperback later this month, and if you haven't read it yet, you might be thinking, maybe even hoping, that it won't live up to the hype. But I'm afraid I can't deny it. This really is a big, smart, emotionally acute, very fine novel. So, excellence defeats envy. Jonathan Franzen, welcome back to Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt. Nice to see you again.
And you. So how did it feel, for instance, when you heard that President Obama had taken an advance copy to his vacation on Martha's Vineyard?
It felt exciting, actually, and I'm normally puzzled by people saying, aren't you excited, aren't you excited, as if that's a good thing. I think of excitement as mostly being a negative. But that afternoon, when somebody passed the word along, I felt excited in a good way. And that had to do with my admiration of him and my feeling this is the first president, not only who's younger than me, but in my lifetime, who I've really been excited about. So it was terrific.
Are you still excited about Barack Obama?
I am. I mean, I'm excited, but I'm also sad because his loss of traction in the last 6-8 months seems to confirm a feeling that increasing numbers of my friends have, that the country has become simply ungovernable.
And irredeemable?
I don't know about irredeemable.
Certainly some of your characters would consider it irredeemable. The corrections was, to summarize grotesquely, about a dysfunctional Midwestern family. Freedom is about a dysfunctional Midwestern family.
Can I interrupt and just quibble
no.
with the word dysfunctional?
Sure. Well, a problematic.
An interesting Midwestern family, right?
Definitely. But given that after the corrections, interesting, problematic Midwestern family, did you have any pause about sort of plowing what looked like the same territory?
All four of my novels have had families that in some way are Midwestern in them. It's the story I have to tell, and the family is just so charged with meaning for me that I can't get away from it. And to speak quickly of my favorite North American writer, you look at Alice Munro, and she's writing the same story over and over again all her life, and her genius is to tell that story in a new way that you feel you've never read before, decade after decade.
I'd love you to read a little bit from Freedom to give the readers a sense of...
I'm taking the book across the little table.
And if you can just sort of set up where we are.
We're in the middle of that overture chapter, the first chapter. The chapter is narrated from the point of view of some neighbors, the Paulsons.
And we're in St. Paul.
We're in
St.
Paul
80s.
In the 80s. The kind of, you know, the sort of Zinfandel and NPR 80s. So I'll start. To Seth Paulson, who talked about Patty a little too often for his wife's taste, the Berglunds were the super guilty sort of liberals who needed to forgive everybody so that their own good fortune could be forgiven, who lacked the courage of their privilege. One problem with Seth's theory was that the Berglunds weren't all that privileged. Their only known asset was their house, which they'd rebuilt with their own hands. Another problem, as Mary Paulson pointed out, was that Patty was no great progressive and certainly no feminist, staying home with her birthday calendar, baking those goddamn birthday cookies, and seemed altogether allergic to politics. If you mentioned an election or a candidate to her, you could see her struggling and failing to be her usual cheerful self, see her becoming agitated and doing too much nodding, too much yah-yahing. Mary, who was 10 years older than Patty and looked every year of it, had formerly been active with the SDS in Madison and was now very active in the craze for Beaujolais Nouveau. When Seth, at a dinner party, mentioned Patty for the third or fourth time, Mary went nouveau red in the face and declared that there was no larger consciousness, no solidarity, no political substance, no fungible structure, no true communitarianism in Patty Berglund's supposed neighborliness. It was all just regressive, housewifely bullshit. And frankly, in Mary's opinion, if you were to scratch below the nicey-nice surface, you might be surprised to find something rather hard and selfish and competitive and Reaganite in Patty. It was obvious that the only things that mattered to her were her children and her home, not her neighbors, not the poor, not her country, not her parents, not even her own husband.
That's Jonathan Franzen reading from his new novel, Freedom. If Patty had had a serious career, would it all have worked out differently for her, better?
She thinks maybe it would have. Without a career, she becomes, one could say, overly focused on her children, particularly her son. And that's one of the things at the center of the book that I was trying to access from my own life and had found no direct way to write about. And one of the reasons it took so long to write this book was I had to develop this entire parallel world into which to pour my own experience. experience because I couldn't write about what was really going on with me in the 60s and 70s. It was just couldn't go there.
Is your mother still alive?
My mom's not. She's still alive in some way. She's alive in me. I feel strains in my own character that correspond identically to strains in hers. And so there are times when I feel my mom is saying something and not I.
As you say, you write a lot about these relationships between parents and children, and especially Patty Berglund and her son. You don't have children.
I do not have children.
Was that a challenge consciously of accessing that kind of unconditionalism that presumably you haven't experienced?
It was not the big challenge, certainly. I think the intense, almost morbid sense of identification I have with my own parents, particularly since they died, and the late dawning realization of what great parents they were, that was probably my primary conduit to the experience of having children. It was through my own parents, oddly.
There was a piece in the New York Times last year saying all significant fiction writers of your generation, including you, are too ambivalent about depicting lusty sex. Seems to me, among other things, this book is an answer to that charge in your case.
I remember that piece. I didn't read it, but there was a bar chart on the cover of the Times Book Review, and I was very happy to find myself in the middle. You know, more sex than writers a little younger than me, not as hyper.
But no Roth or Mailer.
Right, exactly. Not quite the same.
But there's plenty of sex in this. There's a lot of hotness in this book.
There's a lot of sex in Dreams, and you put yourself into that dream state to do the writing, and sex comes along. It's really as simple as that.
Now, what about birds? I know you've written about environmental catastrophes around the world, and I know you are a bird hobbyist. But in this book, Walter's involvement with saving a bird, to me, is depicted as a somewhat ridiculously quixotic exercise. Did you mean it to be that?
Let me say right here that there's a bird on the cover of the American version. Someone made my day the other day by saying they hadn't noticed the bird because it's in such extreme close-up. But I resisted having that bird there because I thought, oh, my God, that's going to send the message environmental novel. And the last thing I feel like reading is a straightforward environmental novel because it's the news is bad. Great. Can't wait to read it. And we know what's right and we know what's wrong. Well, that sounds like an interestingly complex moral landscape.
And do house cats really kill a million songbirds a day, as you say in this book?
Minimum.
Really?
Minimum.
I felt bad about my cats, my two cats.
Cats should be indoors.
So Walter says, and I guess Jonathan Franzen says as well.
Yes, there are some substantial areas of overlap, particularly on the subject of keeping cats indoors.
Now, if you had to look at your success, and it is large, and attribute a portion to your talent and a portion to your hard work and a portion to luck, how would that break out?
Wow, that's a hard question to answer, period, and an even harder one to answer without sounding like a jerk somehow. But if I were to speak in the third person, you know, I'd say, you know, Jonathan Franzen was lucky to have really great parents, although he didn't think so for a long time. And he was lucky and always knew it to have a couple of great brothers and, you know, good health and born at a prosperous time in the most powerful country on earth and had some very good luck finding the right agent and editor. And it goes on and on and on. And even the ability to work hard, to do something that is satisfying, if not always happy-making, and that's what writing is for me, it doesn't even feel like work. I guess that's a long way of saying I think it's all luck.
Did you have other titles, or was freedom it from the beginning?
Not from the beginning, but I had to slap a title on the proposal I sold several publishers 3.5 years ago. And I was in a state of pique about the misuse and the misappropriation of the word freedom in the political sphere in the middle of the last decade, and in a kind of defiant spirit just slapped it on the proposal and then could not bear to speak the title aloud to anyone until I was finished with the book. It was something to write toward. And now I can actually say it. The book is called Freedom. And it's a pompous word, especially if you don't hear all of the irony in which it's meant to be bathed.
If you were all about being a shrewd marketer, it seems like publishing a book, a great big novel, only every 9 years is really working for you. Do you feel like the next one will be sooner or most of another decade?
I don't know. I don't. There's so little time to read. I don't want to claim the reader's attention until I have something new to say. And I at least don't come up with new things to say every 18 months.
Jonathan Franzen, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The novelist Jonathan Franzen. I spoke to him last fall. His novel Freedom is out in paperback later this month. Coming up, we'll head to New Mexico, where in middle age, Georgia O'Keeffe started a new life and a lifelong obsession.
O'Keeffe liked to walk in the desert, and she started to notice bleached bones from animals.
That's where I painted my first skulls, from this barrel of bone.
That's up next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Georgia O'Keeffe always considered herself a Western woman. She grew up on a Wisconsin dairy farm at the turn of the 20th century and then taught school in Texas. She never felt quite at home when she lived in New York City in the roaring 20s, even though she was a successful painter and had a famous artist husband, the photographer Alfred Stieglitz. A new book of their letters chronicles that long, difficult marriage. During one rough patch, O'Keeffe took off for the Southwest and discovered the subject that would eventually define her, old animal bones that littered the deserts of New Mexico. She was in her 40s at the time, but continued to paint them until she died at age 98. To try to understand why those sun-dried bones became such talismans for O'Keeffe, we'll start with Lisa Messenger, who's a curator at the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
In 1929, Georgia O'Keeffe decides that her life has sort of fallen apart. Her marriage to Stieglitz is rocky. He's having affairs. She also felt, I think just personally for her art, that she'd lost her passion for what she was painting. She was kind of having a nervous breakdown. And I guess to bring herself out of it, she decided to accept an invitation to Taos, New Mexico. And that was it. She went up. It turned her whole life around.
As soon as I saw it, that was my country. I'd never seen anything like it before, but it fitted to me exactly. It's just different. The sky is different. The stars are different. The wind is different. I shouldn't say too much about this because other people may get interested, and I don't want them interested.
It's hard to look at New Mexico without seeing an O'Keeffe painting in every direction.
My name is Carol Merrill. I worked with Georgia O'Keeffe for 7 years, from 1973 to 1979. And I was her caregiver, cook, nurse, companion, confidant. I would walk with her, talk with her.
There, that little building beyond is the O'Keeffe house.
I wrote her a letter, and she answered the letter, and her letter back to me said, "Dear stranger," and it was one sentence, and it was, "Whenever you can find your way up here, let us know."
I'm Wanda Korn, and I'm a historian of American art, and I have a very special interest in the artists of the early 20th century, artists like Georgia O'Keeffe.
I remember talking with a little girl when I was 12, and I said, Lena, what are you going to do when you grow up? Well, she didn't know. Well, I said, I'm going to be a painter.
O'Keeffe made her first trip in 1929 to Taos, and she got interested in property there. She began to go back to the same house, a small adobe house in a dude ranch called Ghost Ranch. And then she bought a hacienda in a little village called Abiquiu.
And on the windowsill, there would be all of these little rocks and shells and bones. And at some time, I commented on how the bones made me think about dead stuff. And she said, no, that was once alive.
O'Keeffe liked to walk in the desert, and she'd pick up rocks that she enjoyed, or she started to notice bleached bones from animals that had been killed and left behind. So she'd pick up these bones and bring them home with her, not knowing quite what she would do with them. So on the second summer, she packed up a barrel in which she put some of the skulls that she'd picked up on the desert, and she sent it to herself in Lake George, New York, for the summer.
That's where I began. That's where I painted my first skulls, from this barrel of bone. And first I painted a horse's head, and then I got this cow's head. And I had the cow's head painted against the blue.
O'Keeffe's painting hangs in the Metropolitan Museum, and it's called Cow Skull, Red, White, and Blue.
It's a large, white, very rugged, chipped-looking cow skull smack in the middle of the painting,
with its two horns splayed out to the left and to the right.
There's a black band down the middle of the painting that I think really is probably the easel. And then in the middle, it's blue, like looks kind of sky-like.
And then two red stripes, one on either side of the painting.
And that was at the time that the men were all talking about the great American novel, the great American play, the great American... Oh, it was the great American everything. And I thought they didn't know anything about America. A lot of them had never been across the Hudson. So I thought, I'll make my picture a red, white, and blue. I'll make it an American painting.
When O'Keeffe showed the skull paintings for the first time, the audience for them was a New York audience. It was the same audience that she had been drawing for her flower painting for the last 10 years or so. And the critics discuss the flower paintings as if they could only come from a feminine gaze or speaker. And this became a little tiresome to her because she felt as if what she painted was always tied to her sexuality and not at all thought as male art was, as something coming from an independent spirit. One critic wrote a very little review, but he just didn't even mention the bone paintings, as if he couldn't find a vocabulary that would put femaleness and bones together in some inherent way. And somebody called them gruesome trophies in a sort of headline story. And she wrote to one of her friends saying, you know, I'm just simply not doing what these critics say I'm doing. I'm trying to get a sense of place. I want to get some kind of sense, in other words, to give some kind of Westernness to her work.
I mean, if you're aware of her bone pictures, then when you see a skull or a bone, you rethink that image and you think of O'Keeffe.
We're going down to the vault.
My name is Barbara Bueller-Lines, and I'm the curator at the Georgia O'Keeffe Museum.
We're going to the lower area of the Research Center.
We have in our materials here at the Research Center a variety of types of bones that she collected. You gonna pull that one out?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a deer skull. So they were around the house. And this is, I think, probably a cow's skull. It looks like a cow's skull, maybe a steer. People saw them as symbols of death because traditionally bones are symbols of death. And so they were seen as, you know, in that way when they were first exhibited in New York, her paintings of bones. And she, you know, refuted that.
The bones do not symbolize death to me. They are shapes that I enjoy. It never occurs to me that they have anything to do with death. They were very lively.
The problem with Georgia O'Keeffe is she often told you what things weren't about in her work, but she seldom told you what things were about. So you're left in a quandary for trying to interpret exactly what her work meant.
When people travel now to northern New Mexico, they're often in search of Georgia O'Keeffe landscape. She always worked from nature. She didn't dream these things up. And so you can find many of her sites, and people sometimes do that as sport. They go and find out, where did Georgia O'Keeffe stand, or where did Georgia O'Keeffe make her mental note of how these hills looked.
We are going to do the Georgia O'Keeffe landscape tour, and we travel in a small vehicle and show you folks specifically the different sites where O'Keeffe painted.
I mean, I started saying last year, Georgia O'Keeffe has been very good to us.
Okay. It's kind of hot today, huh?
So my name is Karen Butts, and I'm the Tours and Activities Coordinator here at Ghost Ranch in Abiquiu, New Mexico, and I lead the Georgia O'Keeffe Landscape Tour.
That's the original entrance road. So this is the way O'Keeffe, now you can pretend you're her in her little car, right? And of course, when you look out the window, you see that huge, beautiful wall. So these are the things she saw when she drove in.
Anybody who's remotely involved in the tourism industry, we're totally indebted to her.
So in any case, I want you to look out the window and you'll see the house. We're going to pass it one more time. You'll notice there's a big old tan garage door.
She loved that it was remote. She loved that it was beautiful and quiet and open and natural and undeveloped. That's the same thing that draws a lot of us here.
But she's fascinating, isn't she?
Yeah. So what kind of work did she do after she started losing her
vision?
It's not just, you know, middle age or later middle age women we get on the tour, but there is certainly a noticeable quantity of them that come and attend the tour. They want to try and get a sense, I think, of what drove her or what inspired her.
I'm Noreen Perlmutter, and I grew up in New York. I was born in the Bronx, and then a year ago we retired and moved to Santa Fe. I lived the Southwest through her paintings.
You look at it and it's almost painted for you, you think, until you try. I tried to paint what I saw.
I mean, when I came to the North Southwest, I really expected that the Southwest would look like her paintings, and they don't. Her landscapes are way better in some ways, so it was a shock to sort of see it for the first time.
There's a strip of color. You don't see it because it's in shadow now, but there's a strip of pink, red, and yellow that goes all along over a very long way that I've put in at the foot of my hill.
In my 30s, early 30s, my best friend Fran was coming to New Mexico, to Santa Fe, and she said, is there anything you want me to bring back? And I said, can you bring me back a skull? So she comes home, and she had this beautiful white bleached skull, and there it was hanging in my house in Long Island. It loomed. It was beautiful. And then years later, I retired, and I came to Santa Fe, and, you know, I got rid of almost everything in my house when we came, except for books and clothes, but I brought my skull. How could you not?
O'Keeffe, she would have seen cow skulls used to mark a dude ranch. A dude ranch might have a sign of its name, and over it would hang a skull. And as she began to polish them up and bring them to New York as finished paintings, people began to catch on that these were rather beautiful objects. So although she would hate to have done this to the bone, she in fact was the beginnings of a new regional decoration, what today is called the Santa Fe style.
I don't think people think their house is complete unless they have, like, a cow skull hanging on it. My name is Chris Lajeski, and I'm an interior designer. I have my own firm headquartered in Santa Fe, New Mexico. You know, the five essentials of a Santa Fe home is a Navajo rug, a cow skull, you know, a Native American pot. Everybody has a turquoise necklace and a framed Georgia O'Keeffe poster. You know, I'll do very sophisticated interiors or a beach house where everything is really stark white. And then you put the skull up there and it becomes a really sophisticated piece of, you know, it's an accessory, but it's like a little art piece.
Today, skulls are an utter cliche in New Mexico. There's been such a commercialization of the skull that it's lost its kind of authenticity.
It's almost like she became pop art. You know, everyone used her. And I got very upset when I realized that she wasn't mine. For me, George O'Keefe and the skull are interchangeable. It is the essence of her. It is the rawness. It is everything that she's about.
If O'Keefe were with us today, she would be very surprised about what has happened to her vocabulary that she invented for the Southwest. She kind of carved out a special space, regional space, for the Southwest as opposed to the Wild West. As her paintings became better known by the American public, the mesas, the lava hills, the churches, and the bones, all of this became identified, thanks to the popularity of her paintings, as the Southwest's special area, all on its own, separate from the vast American West.
She actually said to me one day that in 100 years you can't know if anybody will even know who she was or anything about her or even care about her art.
But it happens that the thing that I have done, the things that I've been doing have been in touch with my time so that people have liked it. But I could have been much better and nobody noticed it. Much better, I'll say, as a painter. Some people seem to be luckier than others. I don't know, maybe it's because I've taken hold of anything that came along that I wanted.
When I think of O'Keefe, I think of it as the enormous courage it took to do what she did. She talks about that her life has been like standing on the edge of a knife.
On this knife, I might fall off on either side, but I'd walk it again. So what? What if you do fall off? I'd rather be doing something I really wanted to do.
I hope we keep struggling to try to figure out what she was up to. And I think there are little gifts that she left along the way in her words, but mostly in her art. And it's a mystery, and I love the mystery of it. I can never know the whole story, and that's fine.
Anne Hepperman and Kara Oler produced our story for the American Icon series. You can see some of their photos from Abiquiu, New Mexico at studio360.org, as well as some images of Georgia O'Keeffe's skull paintings. To close our show today, we return once more to the World Trade Center. As we all prepare to mark the 10th anniversary of 9/11, we thought of the sound artist and composer Stephen Vitiello. In 1999, he worked in a studio on the 91st floor of one of the towers for 6 months. He collected, recorded the noises of the building and its surroundings. And he's spent years since turning those sounds into music.
Before I got up there, I had this idea that the windows would open and I would mount microphones outside and always be listening to what was happening. And the big first shock of getting into the studio was that the windows didn't open, that they were very thin, narrow windows looking out, and you could hear nothing. You just heard the cool, kind of cold sound of the ventilators, and you saw all these events that implied sound, airplanes, helicopters, thunder, cars zooming by below your feet, and heard none of it, which made it very flat. So I started looking for ways to amplify that sound and came up to two systems. One was to place contact microphones, very thin microphones, onto the window using the mixing board and equalization to sort of zoom in on certain frequencies and start to hear what was outside. And it was shocking. The first thing I ever heard were church bells. And immediately after that, a plane, and then soon probably just the roar of wind. I've had this image that, and I've said before, that the mics on the window going into my mixing board, into my headphones, became this kind of stethoscope. And there was this kind of intimacy of sitting up there at night especially and just listening to the vibration of the building and getting to know the building and getting to know this soundscape of New York, which was a very different focus than anybody else in this gigantic, otherwise very imposing building was having. The day after Hurricane Floyd was the most dramatic in many sources, because you could really hear the building swaying. You could hear, this was in 1999, and it was one of the two worst hurricanes to hit New York in a decade, and the building was soaked, and the winds were still really whipping the building back and forth, and you could hear it creaking and almost cracking like an old wooden chip. The second set of experiments I did were with a photocell, and I wanted to find a way to translate the light that I was seeing into sound. Using photocells that are used in light meters, we could actually wire them up to audio cables, and when you pointed the photocells at different lights, especially through a telescope so you could get very close, you could actually translate the pulse of the light into a pulse of tone. And so at night, I would do experiments and, let's say, zoom in on a police car or someone turning on and off lights in an office building and actually pick up tones. The Colgate clock, the red clock over the Hudson River, had a really beautiful deep tone. And other white lights gave off a kind of flickering white light pulse that became fascinating and source for all sorts of projects I was working on. I was very nervous after the building was destroyed, the buildings were destroyed, about how to be the most sensitive to the material and how people would respond to it, and felt like I had to wait a little bit, and also understanding this point of view that it was my own experience in own relationship to the building and to the sound of New York, and that it was something I did in 99, I held on to. In a sense, it sort of became more poignant after the buildings were destroyed, but still connected to the work I do in general as an artist.
The sound artist, Stephen Vitiello. Our story was produced by Studio 360's Michael Rayfield. Stephen Vitiello's work will be part of a show at the Museum of Modern Art's PS1 in Queens, New York, that opens next Sunday, September 11th. To mark the anniversary ourselves, we are collecting your suggestions for the best music, movies, fiction, and other works of art and culture that came out of 9/11.
This is Claudia Chadwick calling from Seymour, Connecticut. I was really impressed with Rufus Sewell reading Simon Armitage's 9/11 Out of the Blue. And it meant a lot to me because my cousin, Evan Gillette, died in the tower on 9/11. So it captured the mood, I think.
The day began. The sun like peach, peach of a sun. And everything framed by a seascape dotted with ferries and sails and a blue sky zippered with vapor trails. Beyond this window, it's vast and it's sheer. Exhilaration. All breath. All clear. All lost. All lost in the dust. Lost in the ash and the drift and the black. Now all coming back.
Oh, my love, it's a long way we've come.
My name is Scott Turbin, and I live in Manchester, Connecticut. And a song that most reminds me of 9/11 is The Hands That Built America. The line, "It's early fall, there's a cloud on the New York skyline, innocence dragged across the yellow line," is really visceral because I was working at the Pit post 9/11.
There's a cloud on the New York skyline, innocence dragged across a yellow line.
I was actually not living in New York when it happened, and I called my employer and said, you know, I'm going to go volunteer, and they said, go. So I went, and it was shocking.
These are the hands that built America.
Thanks to everybody who wrote us, and we're still collecting your suggestions. Is there a song or poem or novel or film or other work of art that hits home for you? If so, tell us at studio360.org. Next week, we'll have a special 9/11 anniversary edition of the show. We'll look at how the attack shaped our culture, the music, writing, entertainment, talking with the composer Steve Reich, the performer Sarah Jones, and many more. That's it for this week's show. Thank you very much for listening. Studio 360 is produced by PRI and WNYC. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Sean Twigg,
Rachel Greenberg,
Liz Viella.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum, and thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360.
This is the built equivalent of a moment of silence.
We visit Ground Zero with the Israeli-American designer of the new National 9/11 Memorial.
This idea of absence, of making visible and present what is no longer here.
9/11, 10 years later, next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.